right. I think we do have a quorum now, though, correct?
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I do know we did kindly request for someone to be here early for us, and they have joined us, and so I would like for us to get started, and hopefully Dr. Malat and Ms. Lavoie will be on shortly. The time is now 8:31, and I call this meeting on the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners back in order. We have just a few agenda items to get through today. Ms. Pakanon, can you please do a roll call?
Yes, Madam Chair, Ms. Shreve, Dr. Davis-Wilson.
Present.
Dr. Malat, Dr. Bohansky.
Here.
Dr. Catarino.
Present.
Dr. Davey.
Present.
Mr. Diner.
Good morning, I'm here.
Dr. Gill.
Present.
Ms. Lavoie. And Dr. Meyer.
Present.
7 members present, you have a quorum.
Excellent, thank you. So it is now 8:32 on Saturday, August 15th. We are going to move to agenda item number 22. We do have permission to start that times item at 8:30 today. I guess I have 2 agendas in front of me. I apologize. All right. I want to remind board members that the purpose of the initial review is for, we're going to be talking about discussion, consideration, and possible action related to initial case reviews. I want to remind the board members that the purpose of the initial review is for the board to determine whether there may be a violation of a rule or statute. The board is not conducting an informal interview today. The board may vote to go into executive session on any time on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38431-03A2 to review confidential records and or ARS 38431-03A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. Individuals who wish to speak must complete a request to speak form and provide it to a board staff member. You will be provided the opportunity to address the board. The first complaint we will address under agenda item 22 is complaint number 2039 pertaining to Dr. Kenneth Goldberg. Are there any members recusing from this case? Hearing none, Dr. Gill, you are the lead board member for the agenda item. Would you please provide a factual overview of the case?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This case regards Dr. Kenneth Goldberg. AR is the complainant. AR and his wife, LR, there was a AR filed for divorce in 2015. There was a contentious family custody issue involving the family court. 2 children were involved, Rachel and David. In 2015, AR was given sole custody. It was reported that the mother was accused of physical and emotional abuse of the daughter. In 2015-2016, Dr. Goldberg conducted a court-ordered family reunification, was ordered as the family unification counselor. This involved mother and the children. AR did not participate in the counseling. It's not clear to me whether he was court-ordered to appear or not. In December the 12th of 2018, Dr. Goldberg was appointed an interventionist and provided services again from January of 2019 to December of 2019. He then submitted a final report that constituted 600 pages to the February the 27th of 2020. AR in November the 26th of 2019 requested all documentation from Dr. Goldberg. In response to AR, there was a court order granted in December of 2019. Now, there's history that's also reported as part of the overview. On January the 5th, 2017, AR requested medical records from Dr. Goldberg. The next day, Dr. Goldberg responded that he would, quote, only provide records to the court, unquote. There was a court order regarding this request February the 16th of 2017. 4 months later, Dr. Goldberg submitted a CD file to the court. AR requested records in 4/22 of 2019 from Dr. G, but AR did not receive the records. Now, the legal arguments that are included here, there was an attempt to restrict release of documents, which is perhaps subject to legal sanctions. Psychologists must provide access to the medical records unless laws violated or standards violated. On January the 30th of 2020, the board received AR's claim that Dr. Goldberg failed to provide records despite a court order. The claim was sent to three board members in February. All three recommended opening a claim based upon multiple violations. In February the 5th of 2020, AR submits a, quote, notice of noncompliance and requests a hearing on Dr. Goldberg's, quote, contempt, unquote. March the 3rd, 2020, Dr. Goldberg emailed 2019 interventionist records to AR. On March the 4th, court decided that the noncompliance was moot. Dr. Goldberg reportedly released all information to the parties. On May the 1st of 2020, AR emailed the board. Dr. Goldberg allegedly did not submit a complete record to AR. Now, the allegations from AR include that despite a repeated request, Dr. Goldberg did not comply with the request for records until February the 27th of 2020, then allegedly did not submit the complete record. Court order on February the 16th, 2017, Dr. Goldberg placed all medical records on a CD and submitted them on June the 6th, as reported earlier. On June the 6th of 2017, Dr. Goldberg stated the court may have sealed the records as Dr. Goldberg, being the reunification therapist, in order to ensure information contained in the records did not negatively impact on the children or the relationship with the mother and the children. AR lost full custody in August of 2017. Court ordered a 50-50 custody to both parents regarding the two children. December the 10th, 2018, Dr. Goldberg appointed as a therapeutic interventionist following AR's request for records in November of 2019. Deadline was set for January the 6th, but as has been stated, the report was not submitted until February 27th, 2020. Additional information from the complainant. Dr. Goldberg did not provide the 2015-2016 records. Dr. Goldberg's email of February the 13th, 2020, to AR, quote, I located the 2015-2016 records off-site, will duplicate and send them off. Eventually, Dr. Goldberg sent a partial file that included the 2019 records only. Dr. Goldberg claimed that the 2015-2016 files eventually were destroyed by court order. AR received the files, thought they were complete, found that they were not, and submitted a board complaint on May the 1st. Licensee response. Yes, he was. Dr. Goldberg was acknowledged as the reunification therapist, 2015 to mid-2016. No contact with the family from mid-2016 to January 2019. Court appointed his interventions at that time. Report sent to AR as reported. Publication of the report delayed several times. AR knows, quote, the actual clinical records are scant because AR did not participate in therapy. AR accused Dr. Goldberg of conspiring with mother and children against him. Dr. G dismissed from the contempt charges March the 4th of 2020. Later, AR charge report not complete. And that concludes my summary of this case. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chairman, I would just like to note that Drs. Malott and Davey have joined the meeting.
Excellent, thank you. And they were present from the start of this agenda item, so they should be good to continue. We do have with us, I don't know, board staff, if you have heard from complaint AR.
I do not know if AR is present, but you may want to check to see if he's on the line today.
Excellent. AR, if you are on the line, if you could unmute yourself. All right, hearing nothing, we will go ahead and move forward with introducing Dr. Goldberg and his legal counsel, Flynn Carey. Dr. Goldberg, would you like to make a statement? And if so, would you please introduce yourself and your legal counsel?
I don't know if my legal counsel is here at the meeting or not.
I'm present.
Okay. My name is Dr. Kenneth Goldberg. And as Dr. Gill said, I was originally stipulated to be the reunification professional in 15 and 16. When that term concluded in mid-16, I had no further contact with the family until January 19. One of the issues that came up as I was reviewing the last hearing was Dr. Gill asked what had changed between my not releasing the 15-16 records and the 19 records. And a number of things had changed. In 15-16, part of my reason for not wanting to release the records was there was allegations made by both parents against each other, which if known to the children, in my belief, would have severely psychologically damaged them. There were also allegations against other people known to the children by the parties that would have also damaged them. So after consulting with counsel in January, I had communicated with both legal counsels for the parties that because of my concerns, I was willing to release the records to the court, obviously, but not directly to the parties. There's been this indication that there was a 4-month delay for my, from the motion to have me release the records to when I complied. In fact, they did not get copied on that motion and did not receive that motion until very late, like March 29th or March 30th of that year. So it was actually approximately, a 60-day time frame between when I received notice and I released the records, not 4 months. When 19 came up, as Dr. Gill questioned at the first hearing, why was I able to release those records? It was because the circumstances had changed. In 15 and 17, the court had concerns about the children's safety while in the care of the mother. The mother was not a custodial parent at the time. Father did have full custody. They had concerns about other people that the children may come in contact with, which I also had to evaluate, as I just said. But in 19, the court had deemed that those were no longer concerns for the court. The children, the parents shared joint custody. The parents shared joint physical time with the children. And none of those concerns by the court existed. So I didn't have grounds or cause to withhold the records from the parties in 19. As I said in my report, as well as at the last hearing, when I was reappointed, I deliberately made the choice not to consider any of my previous contact with the parties because it had been such a long time. And as the board knows, people or circumstances change. I didn't want to prejudice my present contact with the parties based upon my former contact with the parties. So in 19, I did not have cause to be concerned about releasing the records to the parties, nor did apparently the court have certain concerns that I had shared with the court in 15 and 16. In terms of my destroying the original records, I hadn't looked at anything once the records were put in storage. So that I was not even fully aware that I had destroyed the records until I got the records out of storage, saw Judge Thompson court order to destroy the records, and the note saying that I had destroyed the records. Upon reflection, like I shared with the board last time, I should have done a better job, in my opinion, obviously, as well as the board's. I should have contacted the board and said, I have this ethical dilemma. I'm not really sure what to do. Can you please advise me? I should have also contacted the court about the dilemma as well. I didn't do that. And I believe that was my error. And I don't have any excuse for that. In terms of the timeliness of the records, the 19 records, as the board's aware, my reunification report was very long. I was trying to publish my report simultaneous to the records so that neither party would have any advantage, and I wanted to remain neutral and impartial to the parties. During the delay in publishing the report, I was frequently in contact with the court, which reassured me that it was okay as long as I kept them advised, which I did. The report was completed on February 27th. It did not actually get to the parties electronically until early March because the file was so large. I had to call in a business associate technologist to break up the file to send it to the parties electronically. As you're aware, the court did not want the clinical records. They just wanted their report. So that was very easy to send. In terms of the completeness of my clinical records in 19, they were complete. I had very little face-to-face contact with the parties, and that in part was part of the delay in my publishing the report because I had to rely on a lot of digital communication between the parties. But I gave both parties all the digital communications that were in my possession at that time. In terms of the 15-16 records, one of my office business associates had gone and found the files, had found the file name in storage and said, hey, I found the file, didn't tell me the details. So until I personally looked at the files, I was not even aware that the files had been destroyed because they were in storage and the case was closed. So again, in retrospect, before I was so quick to communicate to AR, I probably should have eyeballed the records myself and done a better job of communicating. I will note that AR himself went to the court in April of 19 looking for the records, and he was told that the records no longer existed. So he was aware, even though he kept asking for the records, he was aware the records no longer existed, and in fact was aware of the court, Judge Thompson order that the records be destroyed. So I don't know why he continued to ask for them. He actually had more information about the disposition of the records than I did until later in the year. But as of in April, and I think it's documented in my notes, he said he had gone to the court and was told they were not available. Since the last hearing, I have drafted a correspondence and log that goes in every client's file where requests for information are asked for. Since the last hearing, I have gotten at least one request for records every single week. Sometimes it's a guardianship matter. Sometimes it's someone applying for access. Sometimes it's somebody applying for DDD. Sometimes it's for a client moving out of state and wanting their care transferred to a provider in the state they're relocating to. But I feel like I've stayed on top of it, and the log has obviously helped. I guess that's all I have to say at this point.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. Mr. Carey, would you like to introduce yourself, and would you like to add anything?
Yes, thank you, Chair Wilson, members of the board. My name is Flynn Carey. I'm counsel for Dr. Goldberg. I did want to hit a few points. I think this case has been significantly reduced down from where it initially started. There were some other allegations, and I think we effectively showed complaint committee that the other allegations were just simply not founded. I think what we're dealing with right now are the 16H, which is the failure to maintain records, and then the double D, which is the statute that that incorporates in the APA code of conduct, and the alleged violation or potential violation is 102. What we're asking today is the board not substantiate either of those. And here's the issue. This is a late disclosure. This is not a non-disclosure. And the late disclosure does have a basis for why that occurred. We really had two, and this is one thing that I think we should have prefaced. I think this was done more effectively in this meeting, but there are two instances. There's the 2015-2016 records and then the 2019 records. So there's two instances where things needed to be examined. As for the 2016 records, keep in mind these records had, as Dr. Goldberg indicated, significant information about each of the parents, about the children, about people known to the parents and to the children. And there is both an ethical and a legal basis for a practitioner to withhold records when there's a concern that there will be harm to a patient, a client, and a subject that's being evaluated. That's both statutory and regulatory. And what happened is under ethical, Dr. Goldberg applied principle 3.04, which says you have to take reasonable steps to avoid harming. And he used the tiebreaker for conflicts, which says essentially that if you are faced with a conflict, your role as a practitioner is to resolve it. So he has on one side a court order saying produce the records to the parties. He has on the other side, if he produces those records, he's going to potentially harm the children. So he has conflicting interest. There's a conflict there. What he did is he threaded the needle. He has a judge, Judge Thompson, whose job under Title 25 was to be making decisions as to what was in the best interests of the child. And that's statutory. That's under Title 25. When you're in family court regarding custody, parenting time, decision making, it's called a best interest analysis. So you have Judge Thompson, who is in a very unique spot to be looking at the entirety of this couple and this relationship with these children and doing what's in the best interest of the children. By giving the records to the court, he gave it to the person whose job statutorily is to determine what's in the best interest of these children. So that struck that balance, because what he was able to do is he recognized that the conflict would not be resolved favorably whether he disclosed or didn't disclose. So he struck the balance by giving those records to Judge Thompson, who has statutory authority to determine what's in the best interest. And then it became up to Judge Thompson to decide. That is exactly what the conflict tiebreaker requires under the APA. So it was late as a product of him attempting to thread that needle. And it did happen. Eventually, records were disclosed. Records were disclosed by the court. And so the complainant did get those records from 2015 and 2016. He then, under court order, followed the requirement to no longer maintain those records. And there was a legal order for him to destroy the records. As for the 2020 record, 2019-2020 situation, he was not given information about the motion to compel until much later. He did produce the records, and Dr. Goldberg provided an explanation for why that set of records was different than the first set of records. It didn't involve the same issues. There was not a need for the judge at the time to act as a tiebreaker because those records were different in character. I think what I would suggest on the 16H violation, failing or refusing to maintain adequate treatment records, square peg, round hole. 16H really contemplates when a practitioner doesn't keep records properly. For instance, I have this come up in instances where a practitioner doesn't do a treatment plan, doesn't do informed consent, doesn't chart that they have elevated care. Those are H violations. This is where something is not done. If you have a session with someone and you don't do a progress note, if you have a treatment plan and you don't actually do that, or if you have a course of treatment and you don't do your treatment plan, you don't revise your treatment plan with the patient, you're violating H at that point because you're not maintaining proper records. If you maintain the records, and there is no allegation here or no proof that he failed to maintain the records, the fact that the path by which the records were disclosed to the parties took a little bit of a meandering path, H is not appropriate. H really is for the purpose of indicating that someone didn't maintain, didn't properly prepare, or didn't prepare records. And that's not what happened here. And as for the DD violation, which is incorporating the 102, that basically indicates that psychologists are supposed to make sure that if there's a conflict between their ethical duties, law, regulation, or governing legal authority, they cure it. And that is exactly what happened here, both in 2016-17, or in the 2016 situation, he specifically struck the balance that he should have struck, which is going to Judge Thompson and having someone who was peculiarly in a position to make full best interest analysis to decide what to do with those records. The requirement is not that you do everything to resolve a conflict and you check every single box. It's that you resolve the conflict. And if you can't resolve the conflict and you have to make a choice, then, you know, that's a different situation. But this is one where he was given a clear path, which was giving it to Judge Thompson to let him make the decision. As for the 2019-2020 records, he disclosed those. There's no evidence that his records were incomplete. Essentially, AR's allegation is, well, in conjunction with this, there should have been more stuff in the file. The problem is if you go to any of the decree for divorce, you go to any of the records for the 2019-2020 situation, for either time, there are many different instances where AR is the cause of the records not being complete. They're complete as to what Dr. Goldberg has in them. The problem is that AR was actually the cause of his information not getting in there. For example, in the decree of divorce, the court found, quote, that AR attempted to obstruct and frustrate Dr. Goldberg's work. He obstructed and frustrated parenting time. He manipulated his children. He rendered less than honest testimony at trial. He, quote, misrepresented court orders. He, quote, acted unreasonably in litigation. His conduct resulted in two different fee awards against him. So father may not like the fact that Dr. Goldberg's ultimate report did not contain what he wanted it to contain. That's not a failure of the records. That's a failure of AR not participating in the way he was supposed to. And it is consistent with the way he has behaved, that is documented and found by the court, that he was not acting in a reasonable fashion. So in closing, you know, this is a situation in which Dr. Goldberg was faced with an ethical conflict. He came up with an elegant solution of providing the records to Judge Thompson in the first time. And in the second instance, he did produce the records. So he met the standard of care as to what he was supposed to be doing as a practitioner and making disclosures. And if the board were to find that there was a late disclosure here, I think the board should also take into account the fact that he has remedied the process by which he discloses records. He has a process in place. He's taken a significant amount of continuing education. And I would suggest that this is not a disciplinary matter, because the areas where we have concerns about standard of care, I think we've effectively shown that he has met the standard of care. And so what I would be requesting is either a dismissal, or failing that, some form of non-disciplinary resolution, such as a letter of concern about the timing. But I do have a concern that attempting to plug in this case into a failure to maintain records or a violation of the ethical code, I don't think is a good fit, because there's not an ethical violation here. So Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we proceed with questioning, I do want to inform board members that board staff did hear from AR, and the AR did have a technical issue joining the meeting. AR has joined the meeting. We are going to go ahead and proceed from where we are with the questioning of Dr. Goldberg, and then we will go back and hear from AR. So are there any board members that have any questions for Dr. Goldberg or his legal counsel?
This is Dr. Gill. Dr. Goldberg, was AR court ordered to participate in treatment in 2015?
No.
I guess the only other concerns I have are the delays that you had commented on, and I don't know if you have anything further to say about that, but I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
And Dr. Goldberg, do you have anything you wanted to say further about the delays, or do you?
No, again, the first delay in 2015, 2016 was actually closer to 60 plus days and not 4 months. In 2019, the delay was really based on my wanting to publish my report, which was very extensive and required more work than I had anticipated concurrent with the clinical record. But again, I've tried to remedy the board's concerns, whether I'm a day late or 60 days late. I've tried to address those by the log moving forward, so that won't be a problem.
I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who did I cut? Did I cut off Dr. Malott?
Go ahead, Mr. Carey.
Thank you. I wanted to just repeat my thought with Dr. Gill's question. Anytime I think we're faced with a delay question, I think we also have to look at prejudice and whether there was any prejudice. And as we talked about in our materials, and as I think we got into more detail in complaint committee, the delays did not cause harm. In fact, several of the delays that were, there was an allegation that these delays caused AR not to be able to maintain his attorney, when actually we had evidence in there that mother was asking for continuances of the hearing and completely unrelated to Dr. Goldberg. We also had information that we provided by way of phone records that through the report preparation process, Dr. Goldberg was calling chambers for the family court, keeping them apprised of the deadline and the fact that he was needing more time to complete the report. So I think in conjunction with the any late disclosure, the fact that there was no harm that arose from the late preparation of the report or the late disclosure should also be taken into an account. I mean, this is not the case that we sometimes see where a practitioner is faxed by Quail Run or another crisis center and said, we need your records right away, and then you don't hear from the practitioner for 30 days and there's actual potential harm to a patient. This is one in which he recognized, because of the scope, because of delays introduced by AR for not participating in the process and by making Dr. Goldberg's contact with the children harder, some delays did occur, and Dr. Goldberg worked to remedy those, but there has been no demonstration of harm. And so I think that's the other component to this, is that there was no harm in those delays. And I think that changes the character of it a bit. So.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. Dr. Malott, you had a question?
Yeah, this is a question for Dr. Goldberg. Dr. Goldberg, you indicated that you were working on finishing a very extensive report and you got this request for records. Did you inform AR that that's what, you know, that there's a delay and because of these reasons, or what kind of communication did you maintain once you got the request?
My communication with AR was digital. I did keep him apprised, but my communication with him should have been, I'm going to say, more specific. So what I probably did, I'm doing this from memory now, I probably said to him, I think I'll have the report done on this date, and then that date passed. What I should have said to him is I'll notify you when the report is ready for publication. And I didn't do that. And I don't even know where, well, so at the end of the process, when I did publish the report, because I took responsibility for the delays in terms of my publishing the report, I put over 100 hours into the publication of the report, but I took responsibility. I did not charge either party for either the report or the publication of the records. So basically I provided all of that work for free as a way to kind of make up for any, I guess I'm in my mind, distress that I may have caused AR. So there was no cost to him for the publication of the 53-page report or for the 600 pages of records.
And you communicated that with him, that I'm sorry I'm delayed, but as a, you know, but I am.
I don't think I ever used the words I'm sorry, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Bohansky.
I think it's nice you didn't charge him, but overriding everything in my concern is what's in the best interest of the children involved. I could care less about the billing. You were appointed twice by the court.
The first time I think was stipulated. The second time was by court order.
So the first time the parties agreed to have you involved, you were involved. There was request for records. You chose to seal those records and send them to the judge. Is that an accurate statement?
That's what I was advised to do, yes.
There was also a court order for him to produce the records. So the records, he gave them to the judge. The order was, though, for production of records.
So the records were provided to the judge. And the judge can decide the distribution of those records following his review, again, in what's in the best interest of this child.
Yes, sir.
Then there's an order to destroy the records. Is that accurate?
No, that actually was part of the order to produce the records. It was in the same order.
So produce the records and then destroy them?
Yes, sir.
That's an interesting order. I've never seen one of those. But the court had the records. The judge had the records.
Yes, sir.
The judge who was making decisions about what's in the best interest of these children had the records.
Yes, sir.
Okay. The second time you're appointed is 2 years later?
Yes, sir.
And despite any conflict that had happened, 2 years later, you're still re-engaged in this process.
I was re-engaged, yes, sir.
Did either party object to you being appointed the second time?
I have no knowledge of that.
The second time is when you produced the Lankley report?
Yes, sir.
And that Lankley report was in excess of 50 pages?
Yes, sir.
And had addendum in excess of 600 pages?
Yes, sir.
And
well, those were the clinical records. Those did not go to the court. They did not request those.
So what the court requested was your 50-some page report?
With its addendums, which were things such as the DCS report, police report, an order of protection report, whatever the parties had provided me that they wanted me to review.
Dr. Bohansky, just to make sure that we're on the same page about the second time for the appointment, AR was represented by counsel. Judge Marwell, who had then taken over the case, proposed the idea of Dr. Goldberg being reappointed at the October 24th, 2018 hearing. AR was represented at that hearing, and there was no issue raised during that hearing about his reappointment. So AR was represented by counsel. He had a lawyer. Both parties were present and given an opportunity about whether or not that was an appropriate appointment. And there's no evidence that we saw with an objection. Typically, in my experience, if there had been an objection, what would have either happened is there would have been a requirement to propose another one. Judge Marwell would have incorporated into her order something along the lines of the parties have until X date to stipulate. Otherwise, yeah, someone would be appointed.
Yeah, that's my understanding of how that process works. Okay, so in this second, what I would say a fairly comprehensive report, was provided to the court within 60 days of their request?
Yes. Well, I published it the end of February. They would have received it then. The parties received the records, the big clinical records, they received, I think, March 3rd or somewhere around there, because I had to break it up into pieces. The file was too large to send digitally.
Okay. And decisions made by the court were based upon your report?
I don't know that any decisions were ever made, because I don't know that there was a motion before the court.
So you never participated after publishing your report?
No, sir.
You didn't provide testimony or make an appearance before the judge in this matter?
No, sir.
And you received no more queries from the court for any further information?
I've received no further queries from anyone other than the board.
Who are you an advocate for in these type of proceedings?
I was asked to help the children and the mother develop a healthier relationship.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question.
Yes, Dr. Petterman.
Do you have, Dr. Goldberg, do you have the copy of any information from the judge directing you to destroy the records? Is that in a court order?
Yes,
or any kind of written?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that was given to the board, and that was included in my report, my reunification report to the court.
Okay. I was trying to go through it. There were many things just to read, so thank you. You know what page it's on, or and roughly where it is? Is it in your response, or?
I can take a look, Dr. Catarino. Let me see if I have that listed.
And Dr. Catarino, it's likely that the pages that you have before you might be a little bit different, so I don't know if Ms. Michaels can readily access it.
Could they just read if it's a paragraph or whatever it says then? Because they might not be able to find it.
Madam Chair, if I may, this is Dinar. I think I'm looking at the first file on page numbers 53 and 54.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Dinar.
It's also on page three. It says the record shall be destroyed upon completion of this matter in the minute entry. So.
Thank you.
But
I have one other question, but I don't know if this is related, but I'm trying to locate, I believe there was some kind of law protecting psychologists that are court ordered from lawsuits. Is there something like that? Maybe Mr. Carey knows, or Ms. Galvin? I think there's some law protecting psychologists doing.
Got modified couple of years, but Ms. Galvin.
I would refer to Ms. Galvin if she has it at her fingertips, yeah. But my understanding is that before the board will take action on any of these cases, there has to be a review, a level of review before the board will open a complaint in regards to these cases, or the court itself has to order the the complaint to the board based on a finding, I think, of a higher level of negligence. So I can get the statute. I just don't have it at my fingertips right
now. Okay,
Dr. Katarina, the statute is in ARS 32-2081, and that sets, and this is B, that sets forth, I'm sorry, it's paragraph C, and that sets forth the claim process. So if there are court-appointed services and an individual files a claim about those services that are provided, the statute provides that it goes to three members of the board, two professional members and one public member, independently review the claim and determine if they believe that their if there's merit is the standard. If there's merit to open an investigation, then they notify the executive director. And if any one of them believes that there is merit, then a complaint will be filed. So that is the process that this went through. And I believe Dr. Gill in his opening statement said that it did go through the claim process. All three claim reviewers indicated their preference or desire that this go to the board as a complaint.
So the two different roles he had, in the first where he was stipulated and the second where it was court ordered, it applies to both those roles, that process, ARS 3221?
Yes.
Okay, that I wasn't clear on that. Thank you.
And Dr. Katarina, for the to just to piggyback on your question, the idea of merit review, it in my opinion, the purpose of it is because we deal with a lot of high conflict divorce cases, and the idea is to screen out just these collateral attacks on practitioners. Merit's a low standard, and it is typically based on not the complete file. And what I think the board has seen is this has gone from a case where there's an allegation. A laundry list of allegations. The initial reviewers look for merit, which is there enough to go forward? And then there's the due process that we're all engaging in both at committee and now. And so the mere fact of members finding an initial basis to go forward, it's almost akin to when a police officer has probable cause and then the matter goes for litigation or investigation. And so I would just say that the board, the members who reviewed this did not have the benefit of the records that they have now and the discussion that they have now.
Yeah, see, I wasn't sure if what Dr. Gill was referring to was our preliminary complaint screening or it was related to that law. Now I understand. Thank you.
Excellent, thank you. Are there any additional questions for Dr. Goldberg? Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. The only question I have is, how would you resolve the record-keeping issue of maintaining records versus destroying them due to the court order?
You mean moving forward?
Yes. If this were to occur again, what is your plan?
My plan is I will notify the board and say, the court has asked me to destroy the records. I need clarification. I would also notify the court and say, just to remind the court that I'm obligated to keep records. And I would ask those two parties to give me guidance.
Okay, thank you.
And I would also say, Dr. Meyer, and this is certainly not a critique of the APA, but unfortunately the APA had guidance where the statutes could be the tiebreaker up until 2016. And when it added all the human rights components to the APA Code of Ethics, it removed the tiebreaker that was previously there that gave guidance as to how records are handled. And so Dr. Goldberg followed a court order. APA used to have more specific guidelines on when you have a conflict between the ethical code and statutes, how you do those tiebreakers. And then 102 removed that. And so the path he chose was within the ethical code as it exists. Unfortunately, this put him in a rock and a hard place. And I think ultimately going to Judge Thompson to make resolutions and allowing a court order, which does have the import of law, was legally allowed in this situation.
Well, nothing was removed about attempting to resolve discrepancies.
Exactly. And I think that he did take steps, but ultimately he was given a court order by Judge Thompson for destruction of records. And I think he certainly ran the risk of being found in contempt or not following the law if he had failed to do that. With that said, I do think he's laid out some plans for future. And certainly I think Dr. Goldberg would also consult with counsel and ensure that any future situations like this would be addressed before doing anything.
So you said that steps were taken previously to resolve this. What were those steps?
Well, I think steps in relation to how he dealt with the ethical obligation of the different parties having different interests in the records. As for the destruction, he followed a court order.
Okay, so there no
additional steps were taken for that, except to follow Judge Thompson's order.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. Any further questions? I have one comment, and Mr. Carey just touched on it briefly. Dr. Goldberg, in your statement, you did mention that moving forward, you would reach out to the board should you have ethical dilemmas in the future. And I just wanted to make sure that you are aware that the board would not be able to provide guidance on those ethical dilemmas. And so your professional association, your legal counsel, and maybe some colleagues that have subject matter expertise in areas that you're seeking that would be better consult. And I just wanted to inform you of that so that it wasn't misleading down the road and you tried to follow the correct steps and you hit a roadblock. So should you be in a situation where that happens, it would be your professional association, your colleagues, and your legal counsel that you would be consulting with. All right, hearing no further questions, what we're gonna do is we're gonna turn it to AR. AR is on the phone with us. If you could unmute yourself and if you could introduce yourself using initials only, you'll be provided time to make a statement at this time.
Hi, I'm Alex Ramirez.
Thank you. And moving forward, please be sure to use initials only.
Okay. Okay, this case started due to LM's very abusive nature towards all of us. A forensic interview on the children and an upheld order of protection will document this abuse, which is why LM was ordered to undergo a mental evaluation and to determine she has two mental conditions, which Dr. Goldberg has a copy of Dr. Cristiano's report. At this point, I had an attorney who had been in contact with Dr. Goldberg, but yet Goldberg sent the report only to opposing counsel a day before the hearing, as evidenced by his own cover letter. Juvenile court nor DCS agreed with his report that LM should have her full custodial or parent rights restored along with unsupervised time. And I was given full unsupervised custody and LM has supervised CPS visits by the court. After I filed my motion to dismiss dependency and it was granted, Dr. Goldberg produced his June 2016 report. My attorney then filed an objection with the court exposing the factual errors and bias from Goldberg towards me. Again, the family court did not adopt any of Goldberg's recommendation and I still had 100% legal and custodial parent. As trial was approaching, my attorney requested the 2015 through 2016 file so he could analyze it and create the questions to destroy Dr. Goldberg during the deposition before trial. Goldberg did not comply with ARS statute or a court order in producing those records. Trial day came and went and still no records. I had an expensive attorney where I had to prepay brutal amounts for trial and trial prep, where instead of using the money on Goldberg's deposition, it was spent on motions and time trying to get the records. So I couldn't afford my attorney any longer and I went pro per for the upcoming trial. By Goldberg's own admission, at the previous meeting, he didn't send the file to me, but he did send it to Lillian's attorney for trial. I was seriously prejudiced in my ability to cross-examine Dr. Goldberg without the documents that underlined his opinions and recommendations, and Dr. Goldberg was not cross-examined at trial. All the comments about obstruction and interference that is in the decree all came from Dr. Goldberg's report and testimony. Through the private children therapist notes, we all learned that one of the children has sneaked in and read the first Goldberg report and noticed the lies that he wrote. The children told Goldberg directly that they wanted reunification therapy, just not with him. But Goldberg stayed on and acted against the best interests of the victims, and no therapy ever happened. On February 13, 2020, Goldberg emailed me stating he had located the 2015 through 2016 records and will mail them to me. A few days later, the board opens an investigation, and he now claims that he destroyed them. Goldberg's attorney is trying to spin it, stating that the judge ordered Goldberg to destroy his file, which is completely false. My attorney wrote the motion to compel and that it would destroy only his copy once this matter was over, since Goldberg was being so difficult and not following ARS statute, and we wanted the judge to grant it. The judge signed my attorney's order to compel, which was pre-written. At the 53-minute mark from the previous meeting, Goldberg admits to never notifying the judge of any concerns. The judge did not do anything Title 12-related or gatekeeper-related activity, as Goldberg's attorney alleged at the previous meeting. Court order was not for Goldberg to destroy his records. The narrative that Goldberg was withholding the records to protect the children is completely false. Lillian and the children were referred because Lillian had committed physical and verbal acts of violence against the children. I have an interest in knowing the precise nature of the concerns Dr. Goldberg fears might result, given Lillian's history of domestic violence against the children, which leads me to believe...
May I please remind you not to use the names of any individuals?
Oh, sorry. Which leads me to believe it was only withheld from me because it was damaging to LM. He had no issues providing it to mother and her attorney, nor did Goldberg have any issues providing his second file. To address the police record comment from the previous meeting, the case was dropped because my daughter didn't have a witness to the assault, and the note that I was going to use it in court is correct. I have a duty to inform the court as it's a crime to fail to protect your children. Furthermore, DCS then went and removed both children from their mother. Even though Goldberg has acted evil towards me and the children, the court just last month granted me full legal custody and no parenting time to Lillian. To his recent comment that the court, that I called the court about the records, I did call the court and they told me they couldn't locate the file due to swapping judges several times. The file was sent to Judge Thompson, then it went to Judge Bereski, and then it went to Judge Morrow, and they couldn't locate it. They never stated it was destroyed. He produced a very extensive 2020 report, but yet had no meeting with the children and little to no contact with us, just through email. So it's kind of obvious that that was his lengthiest report. Furthermore, he was court ordered to provide updates to the court, and which he did not do. He was also not allowed ex parte contact with the court. I have not read the final report, and I will address it at a later time, along with the missing records that are referenced in the report and missing from the records. I did object to Dr. Goldberg's appointment. I did object to Goldberg's appointment for the second time. And I would also like to note that so from the APA, Dr. Goldberg is violated 2.06, personal problems and conflicts, 3.04, he harmed my daughter and my son through this whole process. He did not reunify their mother, and now they have no relationship with their mother, and now they're probably never going to have contact with her. He did not avoid harm. 3.06, conflict of interest. He was not objective or competent or effective in performing his functions. And then 9, assessments. He did not provide the reports. He created reports, but he provides no reference, no evidence, so I could cross-examine him. Very convenient. And then... 10.10, it says psychologists terminate therapy when it becomes reasonably clear that the client patient no longer needs the service, it is not likely to benefit or is being harmed by continued service. The child, and it's recorded, they requested Dr. Goldberg, they wanted reunification therapy, just not with him, anybody but him. But yet he stayed on and didn't provide no services and damaged the children's relationship. He was acting very unprofessional and not in the best interest of the children. He just wanted to stay on to protect Lillian from anything damaging in the report and to spin the narrative. In his 2020 report, he didn't include anything about the children running away from Lillian's apartment, no food, no clothing, no improper living conditions. He didn't mention none of that in his 2020 report, which I will go into greater detail at a later time. But, and then the order to destroy the records was produced by my attorney, and it was only in reference to his records, not Goldberg's, and I think that's it for right now. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, AR. Are there any board members that have any questions for AR at this time? Hearing none, AR, we appreciate you joining us. We have concluded questions with Dr. Goldberg. There are no questions for AR. So what we will do now is begin discussion and deliberation of as I indicated earlier, the focus of this initial case review is to determine whether there may be a violation of statute or rule. Dr. Gill, would you like to begin the deliberation on this case?
Well, as I said, I do have some concerns about the delays. We're hearing some contradictory information. AR indicated that he did object to Dr. Goldberg being assigned as the therapeutic interventionist in 2019. I'm not sure what to make of that because the court did assign Dr. Goldberg that role. So I'm not sure how the court works if a father in a family matter objects to a certain assignment. Does the court then respond to that objection or not? And if the answer is yes, then if the court did approve Dr. Goldberg, then AR's statement that he stated an objection to Dr. Goldberg being assigned may not have merit. I'm not sure what else to say here. From hearing from Dr. Goldberg, I don't know how. Well, let me just say this. The comments by the attorney regarding maintenance of records, I struggle with this too, because it was more an issue of releasing the records in a timely manner than an issue of maintenance of records itself. I'm struggling with the issue of if we decide on something disciplinary, the harm to the community is not well defined in my opinion, and I'll just leave it at that.
Any comment? Dr. Bohansky.
Yeah, I'll go. As I've stated, my issue is that we all should struggle to do what's in the best interest of children in any custody situation. And quite frankly, the needs of the parents are much less. I'm not viewing us as being part of the adversarial process, but part of the healing process. And that's what I look for. As Dr. Gill states, there were some delays. Certainly there are delays in a 50 plus page report. You know, how many nights do you spend doing that? How many hours? Dr. Goldberg has testified that it was in excess of 100. you know, the error here is not keeping people informed that it's in process. I'm halfway done. I expect it to be on such and such a date, and to keep people informed as to the progress. I think whatever we're constructing in our lives, we like to know what the progress is toward completion. I don't care what that is. Is the error to keep people informed a statute or rule violation? I don't find it there. And frankly, I don't find it in my review of these records and my review of the case. So I'd have to have something pointed out to me other than what's been noted so far.
Thank you. Any additional discussion? Hearing none, do we have a motion?
I would move that we submit a letter of concern to Dr. Goldberg, that we include CEUs for perhaps appropriate consultation and appropriate how best to respond to court orders and the like. And maybe I can receive some help on how to be more specific. But I would make a motion to, as a letter of concern, and include CEUs and a final judgment.
So, Dr. Gill, if I may, at this point, you would like to offer as a stipulation a letter of concern regarding the untimely release of records?
Yes, and perhaps also to follow up on Dr. Bohansky's statement that the focus of concern should be these children. And for Dr. Goldberg to have been a little more effective at least attempting to resolve these conflicts in the best way that might have been possible, at least to make the attempt.
So would that go to keeping the parties informed on the status of his report?
Yes.
And then separately would be a consent agreement for a non-disciplinary order of continuing education, maybe relating to, because I don't know if we're going to get exactly coursework in the areas you responded to, but maybe just generally in the work of forensic report writing.
I'd, you know, certainly second the motion and offer the friendly amendment that he gets 6 CEUs in forensic practice and the standards of practice in forensic work.
Is that acceptable to you, Dr. Gill?
Yes.
And within what period of time would you care to have these CE units completed?
Well, what's an appropriate time, between 3 and 6 months?
6 months.
Six months,
and I would imagine they could be obtained through distance learning.
Yes.
And with the
board, even possible consultation with other experienced forensic, you know, because if there's not a specific type of CEU, just that whole, you know, releasing of records, what and how does one go about it when it's in the best interest of the child, you know, how do you document that? So,
So with the, maybe a focus on just record keeping in general and consultation.
And would the board want to allow Dr. Goldberg to use the CE hours for an upcoming renewal?
No. It should be outside.
And Ms. Galvin, for my clarification, is this a non-disciplinary order or is this a consent agreement?
Non-disciplinary.
It would be non-disciplinary, but at this stage, he would have to consent to it, is my belief.
I believe statute allows the board to issue a non-disciplinary order for discontinuing education?
At the initial case review stage? All right, let me look at that and we'll either issue the order if that's agreeable to the board or if it's a consent agreement. I don't recall right now. And the letter of concern would have to be accepted. Do you want to put a backup plan in this motion that if they do not accept the letter of concern or the consent agreement, then it comes back to the board?
Yes.
Ask them if they'll accept it. They're here.
Yes.
Mr. Carey, do you know if there's going to be an issue accepting?
I would have to look at the consent agreement. Only it's a matter of language. I think it's you're making a non-disciplinary disposition. So typically that's something we take very seriously and we appreciate the opportunity to review those. I can't as an attorney without reviewing the language of it and ensuring that it's consistent. If it's consistent, Jeannie, with other boards, it shouldn't have findings of fact or conclusions of law on an order. So I think if the board were to proceed in this way, there is a very high probability that the case would resolve in that way. But I obviously have to be able to speak to my client, and we need to review the documentation that comes from Ms. Galvin and Ms. Michelson as they prepare it. But I certainly don't want that to be a signal that we're not interested or not inclined to move in that direction.
I suspect it will be resolved. If it isn't, then we will come back to the board for an investigative hearing. But I'm confident we can work out the language. And this is non-disciplinary in nature. So if everyone is clear on what the motion is, then we can have a non-roll call vote.
Excellent. So we have a motion by Dr. Gill, a second by Dr. Bohansky. all in favor, please.
I'd like discussion on that.
Sorry, yes, discussion.
The concern I have is that AR is saying that it sounds like he is reporting he was prejudiced, that the amount of money and time it took to have his lawyer try to seek records to, which is backed up by having to get a court order to get the records, did cost him additional money and potential other harm. That's my concern, is that he's saying that he was affected, and at the very least that court order would suggest that it did take more money and more effort to get records that he had a right to.
Any additional discussion?
You know, as noted, he was represented in all proceedings.
You know, I think he said he could no longer afford his attorney after the extended period of time to do the court order and to get records.
Issues or mistakes made by prior counsel are not of review.
Well, I'm just saying that the lack of supplying records on a timely basis is one of the complaints, and I think that needs to be considered.
So, Dr. Maya, I think the lack of supplying the complete records was listed as a concern, and I think Dr. Goldberg has shared some of the reasons, I think, which is why I know I am okay with the motion moving forward with the letter of concern. There were, and based on what I just heard AR say, I think Dr. Goldberg had to use his best judgment. That's my opinion, though. But AR did want the entire record. Dr. Goldberg, in his professional opinion, gave the information that was, you know, in the best interest of the child. So it's, yeah.
And if I may, just to clarify, looking at the statutes, at this level of the initial review, the board is authorized to issue a letter of concern and a non-disciplinary order. So it will not involve a consent on the part of Dr. Goldberg and his attorney. Nonetheless, we'll ensure that the language accurately reflects what occurred today.
Thank you. Hearing no further discussion, we do have a motion and a second, so we do need to do a vote.
And we probably should do a roll call. I hear at least one dissension, just so the record is clear.
Okay. Ms. Pakanon, can you please do a roll call vote?
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Shreve? Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Malott?
Yes.
Dr. Bohansky?
Yes.
Dr. Catarino?
Yes.
Dr. Davey? Dr. Davey?
She's on mute and on the phone.
Mr. Diner?
My vote is no. I would have dismissed the case. Thank you.
Dr. Gill?
Yes.
Ms. LaBoy? And Dr. Meyer?
No.
5-2, the motion carries.
Thank you. Mr. Carey, Dr. Goldberg, thank you for joining us. AR, thank you for joining us as well. If you have any questions from here, please feel free to reach out to board staff and they will answer those questions for you, and they will be in touch with you on that letter shortly as well.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. May we be excused?
You may.
Thank you.
Have a great Saturday. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. We do have, the next agenda item is complaint 2043, and I do want to just note that that has been granted a continuance, so we will be moving forward with complaint number 2006. Prior to doing so, I do want to check with board members. Are we in need of a comfort break, or are we good proceeding?
Maybe we should take 5 minutes.
Perfect. Let's go ahead and we'll take till 9:55. I'm showing 9:48. So 9:55, please join back into the meeting. I think we're waiting on just a couple of people to join us. I think everybody's back except for Dr. Davey.
Yes, I know he had to step away, but I think that was earlier in the hour. Let me check. It was a brief period that he needed to.
Jennifer, did we know he was absent on the last vote? I don't think that was clear.
He actually emailed me, Jean, to indicate he was a yes vote.
But he wasn't present at the vote.
He was.
He was.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I saw an audio, something on his audio switched. And okay. So the little microphone went away entirely. And so there may have been an audio glitch there, but I did see him on there and I did notice the little glitch out of the corner of my eye.
Okay.
Yeah, I saw the same thing.
All right. Well, it looks like we have everybody back. So if we could go ahead and continue, that would be appreciated. All right. We're going to go on to the final complaint today, which is agenda item 22. Complaint number T2006 pertaining to Cynthia Williams. Are there any board members recused from this case? Hearing none, Dr. Malott, you are the lead board member for this agenda item. Would you please provide the board a factual overview of the case?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Davis William. Diana Davis Wilson. I got confused when I saw Williams in front of me. So Ms. Williams is a certified school psychologist to the Arizona Department of Education. The complaint was brought before the board because of work that she did as an independent school psychologist that was through her business referred to as Upright Consultants. Part of her work as in this business, which is an independent business located outside of a school system, is doing independent evaluations for kids that request these, for the kids that need these evaluations. Ms. Williams submitted the evaluation report to the Mesa Public Schools and regarding this individual that she completed. It was completed as part of her business. The complainant is a non-licensed doctoral level psychologist who is a coordinator of psych services at the Mesa Public Schools, indicated that Ms. Williams is not in compliance with ARS 32-2075A1, as she's providing services as a school psychologist, but is not in direct employment in a school setting. The board office received it via email, and the complainant indicates that because she's not a doctoral level psychologist, she's not partnering with a properly credentialed psychologist, and Ms. Williams did not opt to respond to these inquiries, that it is not appropriate. Staff have corresponded with Ms. Williams and indicated that there might be a violation of ARS Review Statute 32-2084. And it prohibits the use of any combination of words, initials, symbols that lead the public to believe that the representation or the title being used might indicate that this person is licensed to practice psychology in Arizona. The board records also indicate that Ms. Williams is not a licensed psychologist in the state of Arizona, and that if they are a certified school psychologist, they are allowed to use that title, but it has to be within the employment of a school setting or properly credentialed. This has come before the board previously, not this particular complaint, but this particular issue has been raised by the board. And in fact, the complainant, RD, was involved in that discussion when this issue came up. I wouldn't say it came in as a complaint. So Ms. Williams has responded in a timely manner via her attorney. Information included in the response was that Ms. Williams is not under our jurisdiction. We do not have jurisdictions over certified school psychologists. And Ms. Williams is employed as a full-time school psychologist, but with another school district, Fountain Hills Unified School District. She also works as an independent school psychologist through this other business. Ms. Williams subsequently submitted additional information and information was provided both with her communication with the Arizona Department of Education that said that a school district has the right to make the decision if they're going to accept the services. School districts are allowed to hire approved vendors and the relationship between the school district and what they will accept is between the two of, between the school district and the person providing the services. Ms. Williams is a certified school district with the Arizona Department of Education since 1999, and she has been approved as a vendor with the Mesa School District. That concludes my summary.
Thank you, Dr. Malott. Complainant RD, if you are on the phone, if you could unmute yourself and indicate whether or not you would like to make a statement. Hearing none, what I would like to do at this time is have Ms. Williams introduce herself, and it looks like she does have legal counsel. Ms. Williams, if your legal counsel is here with you today, if you could introduce them as well, that would be appreciated, and then you may make a statement.
My name is Cynthia Williams, a school psychologist, and I don't have legal counsel.
Okay.
Ms. Williams, you were represented at one time. Is he no longer representing you?
Correct.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. You may proceed with a statement.
Are you asking me to proceed?
Yes, you may proceed with a statement if you would like to make a statement at this time.
Oh, okay. Well, I responded to the complaint. As you can see that I inadvertently made an error when I, on the invoice where it was consultant psychologist, and it should have been consultant school psychologist. And I apologize for that, and I understand it was an error. If you look at the report itself on page 1, you will see I don't misidentify myself because that is not my intention. You'll see that I have my credentials as school psychologist on that report. And then point number 2 was, was I working under the exemption as stated by the statutes? And I corresponded with Arizona Department of Education, who certifies school psychologists within the state. And it was clear from them, from their response, is that a certified school psychologist working within a school district within the state can work for another school district as contract if that there's no stipulation in your contract. So you'll see that I appended the question to ADE, the response from ADE, and my contract for your review on this matter.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Is there any board members that have any questions for Ms. Williams at this time?
I have a question. Yes. Ms. Williams, are you a part of NASS, the National Association of School Psychologists?
Yes, I am. And it's part of my credential on page one.
Are you, have you looked at the school psychology, the NASP standards and certifications?
Yes, I have.
Okay, if we look at the one here, it talks about the credential, and it looks at Arizona particularly, and it says the credential allows for practice in school settings. To practice outside of schools, one must apply through the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners. So in your job in Fountain Hills, you are practicing within the school, and that's totally fine. But when you're functioning with your own consulting company to another district, you're not employed by that district, you're not practicing within their school, even if you happen to be sitting in their table at their desks. I don't see how you could do that without applying, as it says here, to the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners first. What do you, any comments on that?
That wouldn't be correct if you talk to Arizona Department of Education. It's common for school psychologists to contract with other school districts. There's been a shortage of psychologists for years, and I am contracted as a contractor with Mesa Public Schools, so it is an entity of which I work. So I don't work outside the scope and sequence of my job. And so you don't have to be a PhD in order to contract those services.
So to my understanding, and I checked with different school district psychologists and people that hire independent evaluators before this meeting, and they told me that they only hire licensed psychologists to perform the individual educational associations evaluations. And so I also wrote to the State Department of Education. Unfortunately, I wrote 2 weeks ago, they didn't write back. But, you know, I know that sometimes they've made errors, that, you know, you're talking to a clerk there. So I don't know if they left it very vague. I read what you submitted. Mm-hmm. So it did not exactly say that as a school psychologist, you can function independently from a school. That's the key, the independent position. So,
well, it's my knowledge that you do not have to be a PhD in order to contract your services as a certified school psychologist with another school district. You give them a W-4 form, so then you can generate a 1099 form. You know, whether you use your name, you know, I don't consider myself in private practice either.
What is the Upright Consulting Group? Is that a private practice?
No, it's not a private practice. I made that name as the recommendation of accountant. That's only it. And so that's basically it, because typically I use my name, you know.
I couldn't find the website.
So I don't do, like, psychological services. I don't do anything. I only contract with school districts.
The job that you did is a psychological function. Evaluation is a function of a psychologist.
Of my job. That I do, that I'm certified to do.
For in your district.
So I'm not doing it independent of school district, because the school district employed me.
But you're not employed by Mesa. You function as a consultant to Mesa. That's not employment.
Well, when they give me a 1099, it is. When I give them a W-4.
As a consultant.
And also Mesa Public Schools provided information that says if you want to do independent evaluations, then you must be certified by the state. it doesn't say you have to have a PhD or a PsyD.
Well, so we're talking about licensing, really, not the degree. But Dr. okay,
I'm gonna stop you guys right there for just a second. One, Dr. Catarino, this was one of the points of discussion that we did request that our legal counsel be prepared to help us navigate through for discussion and deliberation, because this was an area in the previous meeting that we were trying to interpret the law. I do ask that if we have questions for Ms. Williams, we limit it to those questions. And then if we're going to discuss the application of the law, I do think that we're going to need our attorney to help us navigate some of that language.
Okay, I was done. That was all I was going to ask.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Catarino. Ms. Williams, thank you for answering. Dr. Malott, did you have something to add?
I think I will reserve my question, you know, based on what you just said, Dr. Davis.
Thank you, Dr. Malott. Dr. Bohansky.
Ms. Williams, are you contracted to the Mesa schools?
I was contracted for Mesa schools to do that particular.
Was the evaluation in question done under that contract?
Yes, it was.
Did the referral come from the Mesa schools or from the family?
It was the parent requested an independent educational evaluation from Mesa Public Schools, which is their legal right to do that. And right. Then Mesa Public Schools says, okay, we approve that, you can do that. And by law, you know, they can choose whoever they want, okay? And so that's, then I'm contacted if, you know, if that's the case, and then I have to submit, I have to be a vendor on Mesa Public Schools, and they have to make a purchase order, okay, for that. And then they cut you a check once the evaluation is complete and submit it to Mesa Public Schools. So it's property of Mesa Public Schools.
So the referral came from the school district, and the payment came by purchase order from the school district.
Correct.
Why is a school district psychologist complaining?
I don't know. I don't know him. You know, this has never happened, so I don't know.
Honestly. Is that school psychologist in any way a supervisor of your work in Mesa Public Schools?
No, I have no supervisor. I've never had dealings with a psychologist in a school district, you know, like that.
But in the case or evaluation in question here, this was provided to you by the Mesa School District per your contract with them, and it was not something done outside of that contract or referral where you did this independently for the parents and post-evaluation ask for a purchase order.
That's correct, everything you said. You know.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Maybe I will add something, Dr. Davis-Wilson.
Dr. Malott.
Okay, so based on living in Northern Arizona, this is an extremely common practice. Certified school psychologists are hired by school districts as vendors to provide psychological evaluation. We have a tremendous shortage all across the reservation and in many parts of Northern Arizona. And schools cannot find school psychologists to employ. Many times these certified school psychologists are under the employment of a licensed psychologist, but then they are contracted, who might have a contract, say, with several schools. We have other agencies that provide this, and in this case, it looks like Ms. Williams, Mesa Public Schools, directly contracted her services. It is a gray line, and it always makes me a little uncomfortable, But as long as, I mean, if Ms. Williams were functioning independently, like in the community, and, you know, parents said, I want to see what my kid is doing, and they get an independent evaluation outside, but this is directly paid by MESA, as based on the recent question that Dr. Bohansky asked. And as I said, in my knowledge, very close knowledge, this is a very, very common practice for school districts. And even school districts that have their own psychologists oftentimes don't have enough psychologists and will employ. The school district is concerned that the person is certified by ADE, and that is their main requirement, that they are fingerprinted and certified by ADE before they will, you know, and they pay the school psychologist directly. So just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Well, I'm very confused here, Ms. Williams, because at first you said the parents contacted you first. Is that correct? And then it sounded like the district contacted you first. Could you clarify that? Who asked for this independent evaluation?
The parent asked the school district for the independent educational evaluation, and by law, they can request whoever they want, you know.
Right. So then who contacted you first, the parents or the district?
I was given the information from the parent, and it was an email from the Mesa Public Schools where they had asked for an independent educational evaluation, and it was approved. And my name was mentioned as wanting to conduct that evaluation, okay? And then I submitted the materials to Mesa Public Schools.
And then they got Mr. Dwyer, the way he was, I thought he was the special education administration, and is that's what his title appeared to have been, even though he is a school psychologist. And so I think in that role is why he questioned this, because he would be involved with all evaluations by in that special education role.
Typically in Mesa Public Schools, it's the director. So I have communication with the director of special services, you know, because they have my credentials on file. Okay. So the director is the one who approves that, you know, whether they're going to, you know, allow the independent educational evaluation. I have never, ever dealt with a psychologist of any sort in Mesa Public Schools or any other.
The way, am I correct that Mesa has different regional directors, but then they have one head special education administrator, and that's what his role, so the directors would report to him.
Well, I know that Mesa Public Schools went under a big transformation in the last, say last year. And so there was, from what I understand, a lot of changes. The director secretary was out on maternity leave. And so it seemed to be handled a little bit differently across the board. But, you know, my purchase order, the information that I was to do it came from the director as being approved from the parent to do the independent educational evaluation.
Okay.
And then I submitted the information to that district, okay, which they have my certification on file and stuff like that.
Okay.
Okay.
Dr. Meyer?
Thank you, Ms. Williams. You submitted a contract for Fountain Hills District, but I didn't see anywhere in the records a contract for Mesa School District.
Because you don't get that contract, it's my employment contract in Fountain Hills. When you do contract work with school districts, okay, outside of your employment, okay, that you're never ever submitted a contract. You do contract services and they pay you with a 1090. Well, at the end of the year, you get a 1099, but you have to submit the W-4 as a contractor. That's why you're a vendor. You're considered an approved vendor. That means they've had all your credentials. You've been approved to be a vendor and to do these services. You're within, you know, your legal right as your certification allows.
Okay. So did Mesa assign this case to you as part of employment with them or did parents approach you with prior approval from MESA to get an independent evaluation? Did parents approach you and say, we want you to do the independent evaluation?
No. Well, I got the email from the parent, okay, that was the correspondence with
the MESA did not assign this to you.
Yes, they did, because they hired me to do it.
No, you were paid after the fact for your work, right?
No, I had to get a purchase order to be approved to do the job.
Yes, after the parents selected you.
What?
After the parents selected you to do this.
Yes.
Okay, so MESA did not say, we want Ms. Williams to do this evaluation.
Yes, they did after the parents said it, because that's the parents' legal right, and it's in the statute of 300.502 that says a parent has a right to obtain the IEE, you know?
That's not my question. Did you submit the email that said MESA assigned this to you?
No, I didn't, but it was from the director that approved this parent, because the way the chain goes in a school district is that you cannot do an evaluation unless that director approves for you to do it, and then it has to go through the next step that you're on their vendor list. Then it has to go to purchasing, to the business office, and they have to give you a purchase order, okay, to do the job. And then you do the job and you submit the invoice, and then they give you a check, and it's all MESA Public Schools. So that is who I work for.
Okay. But to be clear, you don't have a contract with them.
No, I don't have a contract like I do with Fountain Hills Unified School District. No contractor does.
Okay. Those are all my questions. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Mayor, Ms. Galvin, I know that we asked potentially for just some guidance on the reading. Would you like to do that now, or would you like to wait until we conclude questioning?
I think that's up to the board if anyone has questions or to seek legal advice, or if you want to start deliberations, or if you have more questions. Of
I think we have questions of you, Ms. Galvin. Do we need to do an executive session?
If you seek legal advice, yes.
Yeah. Okay, I'd like to call for an executive session.
And I'll second that. And so what we're going to do is we're going to move into executive session for the purpose of receiving confidential advice from the board's attorney. At this time, Ms. Williams, if you'll just hang tight, the board members are going to either come off the call, some choose to come off, some will mute and stop their video. Board members, we will be using the regular executive session line. Ms. Michelson has emailed that out. Excellent. And I believe that Ms. Pakanon will stay in this call with the participants. So Ms. Pakanon will stay. Everybody else will be leaving to go to executive session.
May I ask Ms. Williams one question before we go to an executive session?
Yes.
Ms. Williams, are you employed by the MESA School District?
I'm not employed under contract. I only do contract services requested by any school district. Okay.
Somebody else just joined the call, Dr. Davis Wilson. I'm just wondering who that is.
I don't know that. But we can
see them. We are going to be moving into the executive session. I think Jean left. I think we actually needed a vote on the executive session.
You can make a vote right now. We've got enough people.
Okay. All in favor of going to executive session, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, we'll go to executive session. And when we return, Dr. Malat, I will double check, or maybe Ms. Pakanon can double check that we didn't have RD join the call.
Members of the public, this is Heidi Packen, the board's executive director. Has the complainant for this case, RD, joined the meeting? If so, please unmute and indicate you're present.
It looks like we have everybody back. Ms. Pakanon, were you able to confirm whether or not RD has joined us?
Madam Chair, I requested the complainant to self-identify and didn't hear anyone speak up. So I think we can assume the complainant's not with us.
Excellent. Thank you. Prior to going into executive session, we were still in the question phase with Ms. Williams. Are there any other questions that board members have for Ms. Williams? I have just one. Ms. Williams, if you wouldn't mind, when a parent, and I don't know if you know this information, but when a parent from Mesa Schools does request that independent evaluation, did Mesa Schools provide that list? Can you clarify for me how that parent got your contact information? Because generally what happens is they provide their vendor list and say, here's our vendors, choose from one of these. And you are on mute, so if you are able to hear me.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Hold on. I'm trying to, oh, there we go, the video. So I don't know that answer to your question. I know I had to provide my credentials to Mesa Public Schools in order to do independent evaluations or any contract services for them, you know? So that information, my credentials was sent in like 2016. And I was put on the vendor list once they review, you know, the district reviews your credentials and so forth, then you're put on the vendor list that you can do contract work for that district if need be.
And for Upright Consulting, do you have a website?
No.
Do you have a separate email or phone number for families to contact you directly through Upright Consulting?
I don't have a separate phone number for Upright Consultants. Okay.
So it's mostly just a kind of an LLC that was set up by your accountant?
Correct.
That is all the questions that I have. There any other questions? Hearing none, what we're going to do is we are going to move into discussion and deliberation on this case. As I believe we've indicated, so Ms. Williams, what will happen now is you can go ahead and mute yourself again. We have no further questions. And what we will be doing is just discussing the findings on this case. And I do believe, although I lost my notes, that this is an initial case review to determine whether or not there's a violation of statute or rule. So I just wanted to remind the board members that this is just an initial case review. Dr. Malott, would you like to begin the deliberation on this case?
Yeah, I would. Thank you, Dr. Davis-Wilson. Ms. Williams wasn't employed as a contract vendor to perform this independent evaluation. She did what she was told and she was paid by the district. I think a point of clarification is if Ms. Williams did the evaluation, and I think we do need to have some kind of, if Ms. Williams did this evaluation on her own and she was paid directly by the parents and she's not a licensed psychologist, then I would see that as a clear violation of practicing independently. Since Ms. Williams was appointed by the school district to perform this independent evaluation and the report was provided, and if I'm not mistaken, she is covered by the school district, even in terms of a legal challenge to whatever finding she came about, then she is in the employment of the school district as a vendor, as somebody who's working limited hours, which then results in a 1099. I think the term that she used was inaccurate. You know, she's a certified school psychologist. And I would caution that she continue to use that term based on her credential, and that these independent or these evaluations have to be done in the employment of a school district and not in the community where you set up practice and, you know, parents will come and then they may use your report and take it back to the school and say, hey, you need to, you know, they may contest. And we've seen that with our own licensed psychologists. So I think we need to make that distinction between somebody who's in the employment of a school district and the school district who's paying their services, and the school district's certified school psychologist is allowable term, not only by the Arizona Department of Education, but also by, in our statutes, we have a provision for certified school psychologists.
So I have a question with that. Since it's in the name of the job she did, independent educational evaluator, I don't see that she's employed by the district because she has to be independent to do that job.
I think if that is a concern, we need to take it up with the Arizona Department of Education, who will then need to instruct their schools that they cannot employ people who are not licensed, as long as there is no direction coming from ADE to the schools. And the schools need these evaluations. And nowhere in ADE does it state that the person doing the evaluation has to be a licensed psychologist. We may need to take it up as a board with ADE and get that clarified. But as long as ADE says that people who do these evaluations must be certified, and Ms. Williams met the certification law, and that the school district is paying for these evaluations, so the certified school psychologist is caught between a rock and a hard place. The school district is willing. The law says it's up to the school district to make the determination on who they will employ. They will contract with certified school psychologists. And part of my strong feelings also come from, we have an entire part of our state, half of our state have no school psychologists employed. They contract and employ certified school psychologists to provide extremely needed services to kids. And if we say this is wrong, we are basically, there's probably 200 certified school psychologists providing these services. So,
I'm going to turn it to Dr. Meyer. Dr. Meyer, while you're unmuting yourself, I'm going to just let Ms. Williams know that at this point we are in deliberation. So we'll just be discussing as a board. So there would, unless there's something that comes up that is a direct question that we decide warrants participation at this time, I will just be calling on board members. Dr. Meyer, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I see it, there's a clear distinction here between schools contracting with vendors to provide services for the school versus schools having to pay for a second opinion. Okay. This was an independent educational evaluation, which was a second opinion, not a service. The school had already provided the service of testing. Okay. And so to be able to do an independent educational evaluation, even if the school's paying, that is not under the employment of the school district. That's a fee for service. Okay. And the email from the complainant states that there is no contract, that they have not contracted with her. She was listed as an appropriate vendor, as just like providing clients with a referral list. Here's some people that can provide services. My understanding is what brought this complaint up, though, is that when they were reviewing the credentials for Ms. Williams, they noted that she's not a licensed psychologist and can't be doing independent evaluations. That's why RW, I think, was asking her for additional,
RD, yeah.
Was asking for additional, credentials, because he said that a school psychologist may not function as an independent evaluator without appropriate licensure for your organization. So I agree there's a shortage of school psychologists, and we don't want to restrict that. But to be doing independent evaluations, you need to be licensed as a psychologist. And unless there's a contract from the Mesa School District, she's functioning independently and not under the employment, not within a school district.
Yeah, I agree.
Thank you.
And Dr. Meyer and Dr. Catarino, I do agree as well. And as on this particular case, looking at it from more of a perspective of a public member and an individual who is a consumer of, the special education services and has the special education rights afforded to them, I think as a parent, moving forward with an IEE is essentially my ability to say, I am disagreeing with the district. Right. And by saying I am disagreeing with the district, I think it would be concerning at a due process level for my IDEA rights to say, well, but we've got this employee that's going to or can or we're going to employ this person. And I would argue that to some level, the legal liability of the independent evaluation is also separate, because essentially what I'm doing is I'm saying I disagree with you. And I think I would feel uneasy as a consumer to know that there's some sort of oversight being provided, whether it's at an employment or supervisory level, to the one person that I'm seeking a non-biased independent evaluation for. Now, having said that, I still stand by, I still kind of see three categories in the school psychology, and I do know that there are school psychologists that are 1099 contracted for the year or for a quarter because maybe the person they have on staff is on maternity leave or what have you, that are still 1099 contract, but the intent of their services are to provide those services as directed by the school. And I see that independent evaluation as, again, I don't want the school services at this point. I'm disagreeing with the school services. I need something independent of those school services. Mm-hmm. And so I'll get it in just a second, Dr. Bohansky. With that being said, I do want to add, though, that there is a shortage, and I think that this is muddied to a level that goes beyond Ms. Williams in this case. And so I also agree with Dr. Malott that I don't know that, I mean, in decisions that we make, we kind of set precedents. And I think the issues come down to not just the interpretation of that law, but also there are state and federal definitions of employment. And I think that if we're going to argue that those definitions are what we're challenging, then it might be an argument of we need to potentially review the statute itself. Dr. Bohansky.
A couple points. First, Mesa is the largest school district in the state. There's no question about that. Second, Mesa employs more school psychologists than any district in the state. They have lots of resources. Third, a parent can have their child evaluated by one of those psychologists in the Mesa School District and freak out, completely disagree with that evaluation and say, I want an independent evaluation. I disagree with the Mesa Special Ed Department and their psychologists, and they probably go out and talk about each other and what they do, and I disagree with what they're doing with my child. I want an independent eval. Now, by federal law, Mesa is responsible to pay for that independent eval. That's what the law says. They got to pay for everything that happens in a charter school. They got to pay for everything that happens independently. They're responsible. So the parents find the best school psychologist in another district. They go to Fountain Hills and say, there's this great school psychologist who's employed full-time out in Fountain Hills, and she knows school stuff better than anybody. She's been doing it for 50 years. We're going to ask her to do the independent evaluation. She's a certified school psychologist. She could do it. Well, so could Dr. Myers. He's a psychologist. But they want somebody who knows school stuff. So they go and they find this Fountain Hills psychologist extraordinaire, and they know Mesa has to pay for it. But the one limitation that Fountain Hills psychologist has is she can only work under the auspices of a district because that's what her certification says. She can't work independently. She can't open her own practice. She can only work under the auspices of a school district. So Mesa says, knowing that, and also knowing that they're responsible to pay her or pay for that family's evaluation of this, they contract with that Fountain Hills psychologist to be the independent outsider that comes in and does this evaluation. So now they have their independent evaluation, and it's done under Arizona law that says a school-credentialed psychologist, a certified psychologist, can only function under the auspices of a district. So they hire her, they pay her, she provides the independent evaluation. That's the way I understand this works. Yes, the parents could have gotten an independent eval from Dr. Myers or Dr. Gill or myself, but they chose to go with a school psychologist, so they limited to someone who had to be had to be paid for by a district because she couldn't function independently. Whereas Dr. Gill or Dr. Meyer or myself, the school could have paid us, or the parents could have paid us, and we could have done it independently. But the parents did it the way they chose to do it, according to what they're entitled to under federal law and within the guidelines of the Arizona law that says certified school psychologists can only work within districts. And they took someone contracted full-time in Fountain Hills and gave her a one-time contract or one-time purchase order, rather, to do this evaluation, because here they had the brightest psychologist they could from another district be independent in this evaluation. That's the way this appears to me to have come down.
I just want to add one more point. I think the two words that we're struggling with is the word doing the evaluation independent, meaning, you know, you're not directly as a full-time employee of that district. So you're providing another second independent opinion versus practicing independently like we would assume somebody in private practice. You know, it's the same word. You add the ly, and it changes the definition of the word to some extent.
Dr. Davey, I'm not sure if it's just connections or if you wanted to add something, but I do see your mic.
Yeah, I did. I just wanted to, after Dr. Mahansky's discussion there, I think it's just important that we realize exactly what Dr. Mahansky laid out. And listening to this, I understand Dr. Meyer's concern, having been someone who's worked in the school district for most of my career. And, you know, I get calls to perform IEEs, to which, you know, because I'm on the vendor list, and I have to tell the nice person on the other end of the line, whether they're from Mesa, the largest school district, whether it's the parent reaching out to me or some other tiny school district down in, you know, like Douglas, that I am not a psychologist. I'm a behavior analyst, and I do not perform independent educational evaluations. You know, in this case, as Dr. Mahansky pointed out, the licensee or the lady that is our the complaint is filed against, you know, she is operating as a certified school psychologist, not as a licensed psychologist in that. And with that, I move that we dismiss this complaint.
We do have a motion.
And our seconds.
We have a motion and a second. Further discussion, Dr. Meyer.
So those are all great points. The only distinction I would make is we have not seen a contract. If this were contracted even for a single single instance, that there should be a contract demonstrating that, not just a purchase order, but there should be a contract.
Dr. Meyer, can I respond to that?
In just 1 second. The complainant said that the IEE is for the purpose of collecting a second opinion separate from the school district. So there needs to be some kind of contract that stipulates that they get paid regardless of the findings or anything like that. I agree, and I don't want to limit restrictions. I think this is a great case for the discussion has clarified this for me. But without a contract, it looks to me like Ms. Williams is functioning independently as opposed to just the title of an independent one. So that would be my only thought, Dr. Davis.
Yeah, so Dr. Meyer, I'll just comment that school districts will not provide a contract. They will vendorize you. There is probably not a mechanism in any school district that I've worked in where they have provided me a written contract in almost a decade of operating in the schools. We receive a PO. We've been vetted to be on the vendor list for the services we provide. I'm not sure what ADE's view on that is, but the district's business offices, the district's lawyers that are involved in many of these due processes will flat out tell you there's not going to be a contract. So that's, you know.
So at that point, you all have addressed all of my complaints.
Well, and I still have concerns because I do think, first of all, there are many licensed psychologists that do specialize in school programs. So this was not the only person, Dr. Bohansky. I have worked for districts part-time, and I did receive a contract, and I wasn't on a vendor list. And the other point is I do think we're setting a precedent here for school psychologists that cannot perform psychological functions outside of the school, that we will be opening the floodgates, and this will be a real problem in the future if we allow people that are not licensed to do independent psychological services. So I think it's very important.
I respectfully disagree. I think the school system needs to have latitude to be able to engage certified school psychologists to perform these.
Well, the districts I checked with before said they don't do that. Here.
I would like to finish my thought. Just as the school system and this board has allowed for an exemption for a certified, a board certified behavior analyst to operate under the same exact exception in schools without being licensed as a behavior analyst. So this is concurrent with our view on the exemptions and on the practice.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Dr. Catarino, I think that I agree, again, that in the big picture of things from consumer perspective, I have also not had experience with the schools providing contracts. Oftentimes it is done in a purchase order type fashion. Schools do have the options of approving non-vendors for IEEs. So again, it can continue to get muddied in a bunch of different ways, but I am going to go ahead and proceed at this point. We do have a motion. We do have a second. The motion on the table at this point is to go ahead and dismiss this complaint. And that was made by Dr. Davey. The second was by Mr. Dinar. Ms. Galvin, would you like a roll call vote?
Yes, please.
Ms. Pakanon, if you would not mind.
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Shreve, Dr. Davis-Wilson.
I'm going to say yes. I'm going to add a small commentary that for the record, I think this is something that needs to be further reviewed. I don't think that it's an isolated issue for Ms. Williams. I don't want to hold her up in this process. It's a much bigger issue. But again, as a consumer, I am concerned at how we're applying the word employment. And I think that when we crosswalk that language between employment and what the legal definition of employment is and how we're interpreting the statute, I'm concerned that we're not being consistent with other statutes.
Yeah, Dr. Malott? Dr. Malott?
Yeah, sorry. I'm going to say yes, but I'm also going to add a statement. I think I would second the, I'm not second, but I would confirm the need for additional discussion. I would like to see ADE involved, maybe their legal counsel, as well as the Arizona Association of School Psychologists. They are the body that represents school psychologists, and getting their opinion on this, you know, who is really allowed. So schools have guidance. I don't want them coming before this board every time they're asked to do this independent evaluation you know, creating this climate of fear. So we need to clarify it. So, but it's a yes.
Dr. Bohansky.
Yes, and I won't make a comment. I talked enough.
Fair enough. Dr. Catarino?
No. One comment I wanted to make is that Mr. Dwyer was president of the Arizona Association of School Psychologists, so we can see where he stands. But go ahead.
He's done. He's not the president.
He was.
Yeah.
Dr. Davey?
I'm a yes.
Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Gill?
Yes.
Ms. LaBoy and Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
The vote is 7-1.
Ms. Williams, we appreciate you being here. The motion does carry. We do appreciate your time, and we will hopefully work with the stakeholders on getting further clarification for individuals that are in your current position.
Well, I thank the board for, you know, reviewing this case because that it's correct with the contractors and, you know, having a conversation with Arizona Department of Education, like you said, Dr. Wilson. I appreciate your time and thank you for the dismissal. And you guys have a great day.
Absolutely. Have a good weekend.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
All right, board members, we are officially at agenda item number 24. Let me go back to 23. I know that we had already discussed that, but from this last vote, it does appear that we would like to add one additional item under item 23, and that's new agenda items for future meetings, and that's going to be specific to this discussion of. What did we say the statute was? 32, I thought I wrote it down, 2075, specific to exemptions and kind of both that interpretation and then how we look at the independent evaluation versus employment and how we get those stakeholders together to have a conversation to ensure that the precedents that we state does not interfere with the operations that we know are necessary for the children in the state of Arizona. So, any additional comments to that or any questions regarding adding that to a future agenda?
Seconded.
Excellent. We are moving forward. All right. For agenda item 24, we are set to adjourn. Any motions?
So moved.
Seconded.
Second.
And Dr. Bohansky has made a motion, seconded by Dr. Meyer. The time is 11:08, and we are adjourned. Thank you guys so much, and thank you, Dr. Malott, for taking some of those case reviews for me to alleviate a little bit of the additional pressure of being chair for the first time. So
welcome, and everyone is invited to go to Lake Mary. That is the view behind. It's only 90 degrees or 85 degrees here, so I'm inviting y'all to Flagstaff. So.
Well, thank you.
If that offer's not good enough, I'm joining the Board of Osteopathic Examiners in like 30 seconds if you'd like to join there.
Can we send you a big cake or something?
Not a run. Bye.
Bye.
Happy Saturday to you, Ms. Galvin.
Happy